Protecting what matters on The Right Choice, AM 1230, KPRL, 99.3 FM with Barry Fisher. Advice and information on protecting what matters most in today's world. Brought to you by Adler Belmont Insurance Brokers and their new associate, Heather Bordan, serving the commercial insurance needs of businesses on the Central Coast.
It's Tuesday. It's 1230. The bear is in the building. It's time for Protecting What Matters. PWM is the broadcast that helps you become better shoppers and buyers of services and products to protect various aspects of your life, health, and property. We also explore current events, our history, community, local treasures, institutions that are notable and worth preserving. Today, we've got some good guests. I'm waiting for our first guest to call in, so we're going to take a minute, though. His name is, we have a nuclear physicist coming on from 1230 to 1. His name is James, hopefully. His name is James Walker, and he is the CEO of a company called Nano Nuclear Energy, Inc. We're going to talk about why next-generation micro-reactors may be the answer to creating carbon-free baseload energy. We're going to talk about the components of NanoNuclear's vertically integrated energy supply chain and progress and next steps in deploying the first micro reactors in the United States. And again, hopefully James will be calling in here shortly, and we'll be talking to him. It's a fascinating topic, and I'll tell you how it came my way. From 1 o'clock to 2, we have our old friend Greg Haskin, Executive Director of CoLab, the Coalition of Labor, Agriculture, and Business. We're going to chat about more nonsense and lawsuits that are coming our county's way over the Oceano dunes. Will this story ever go away? We're going to spend some time unpacking Measure H, the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments sales tax increase initiative that you're going to have an opportunity to vote on November 3rd, and other SLO County issues and news to watch as we enjoy the Mid-State Fair and the summer. You can call in with questions or comments, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. So this is an interesting topic, and I guess what really that I'm hoping that James is going to be calling in on, and if he doesn't, we're going to shift gears and talk about how you felt our country's 250th anniversary birthday went. But interestingly, I was contacted by James' company, his public relations shop, wanting to talk about their company. It's a four-year-old company, Nano Nuclear Energy, and they're building nuclear reactors, micro nuclear reactors. And it's an interesting topic, and I don't know if any of you got a chance to watch the movie, Hail Mary. I didn't see the movie, but I actually read the book. And what really piqued my interest is that NanoNuclear is actually starting to develop nuclear reactors that could go on spaceships and on the moon and Mars to be able to power up the stuff that's out there. So it's an interesting topic. They've got it, and I've said that too many times already. They've got an amazing board of directors, advisors, really, which includes a former Secretary of Energy, Rick Perry. He's also a former governor of Texas, retired four-star general, Wesley Clark, and a whole bunch of former military. There's James calling in right now.
Okay.
James, welcome to Protecting What Matters. I was starting to get worried about you, James.
Well, me too. I was difficulty, so like I'm beginning to pack myself.
Well, you know, you know how to build nuclear reactors, and that's all that counts for this show today. So,
okay, good. I can do that.
Yes. So we are live and on air, and so we're just going to roll with the topics here. Okay. Welcome to Protecting What Matters. I was telling the audience a little bit about how we connected through your public relations arm, and the fact that one of the things I didn't tell you about when we talked last week was I actually just finished reading the book Hail Mary, which was what the movie was based on. And while they weren't using nuclear reactors in the book, it was all about interstellar travel and how the challenges of the physics of the whole thing. So I'm really looking forward to you talking about what you're doing in the space program. But tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and nanonuclear energy.
Great. No, very happy. So I'm James Walker. I'm the CEO of Nanonuclear Energy. My background was as a nuclear physicist. I started on submarine reactor systems and primary and secondary systems of those reactors. And then I got sent on a nuclear physics master's, and then I got to Rolls-Royce, where I worked on the design of the next generation of nuclear reactors. And then I got promoted out of that role into managing reactor core manufacturing facilities and nuclear fuel reclamation plants. And then when I was moved to North America, I started about 5-6 years ago, initially focused on very small reactor systems, and we've since expanded into reactors to try and power for things like data centers, island communities, oil and gas projects, mining projects, areas like that. And since then, we've taken the company from being strictly a reactor company to being involved in nuclear fuel transportation, nuclear fuel cycle facilities, and even consultancy work.
Hmm. And you actually, you must be on a cell phone because you're breaking up a little bit, but you were also worked for the British Ministry of Defense. What did you do for them?
I did. So when I worked for the Ministry of Defense, they were concentrating on nuclear submarines. And nuclear submarines, as you could probably infer from the name, are all propelled by nuclear propulsion systems. So very small light water reactor systems that are placed inside submarine systems. And my job was principally, at the beginning, mechanical engineering around those systems. And after that, when I got the Ministry of Defense sent me on my master's in nuclear physics, I moved from there into the design of the next generation of nuclear reactors for the next generation of nuclear submarines. So thermal hydraulics, nuclear reactor physics, and I was even involved in the construction of rigs that simulated the physical properties of reactor systems, and I monitored those as well. And then I ended up becoming the UK subject matter expert for nuclear fuel reclamation, as well as being the chief engineer on the construction of a chemical plant to recover fuel from old fuel plates for the government as well.
So tell us just real quickly, because obviously our folks are familiar here with nuclear reactors on ships. How are they different on ships than what you're developing with nano?
Oh, well, there's a huge amount of difference. I would say that the principal difference, and this is probably quite an important thing to understand as well, because we get asked, why can't you just simulate a submarine reactor system on land? And, we've been doing it for decades, and surely the tech is already there. But there are some very fundamental differences. So, for instance, when you have a reactor on a submarine or an aircraft carrier like you do in the U.S., those reactors are able to use fuel that would not be available to commercial companies. And the difference there is that the level of enrichment that the military is allowed to possess can be really whatever they want. And typically, the isotope that you're interested in is uranium-235. That is the fissile component that creates the fission chain reaction that creates the energy output. But the military will use sort of 90% plus uranium-235 isotope enrichment, whereas the commercial companies, they're capped. They can only really operate legally up to about 20%. Hmm. And actually, even that 20% is not readily available today. So typically, even those big Homer Simpson reactors that you'll see, as you're driving in your car, those things are using sort of 5%. Uranium-235 levels of enrichment. So, because that's what's currently available with the existing infrastructure. So I think the fuel is the most fundamental difference, and that dictates a lot of design decisions around what you can utilize, what we as a commercial company can utilize, and what the military can build out.
So just to put this into perspective, I looked up, after our conversation last week, I looked up how many gigawatts Diablo Canyon kicks out as baseload power. And it looks like, based on the research I did, that they have two pressurized water reactor units at Diablo Canyon, and each is a bit over 1,100 megawatts of power. So in the prototype, your first prototype, which you're getting, and I want you to talk about that here in a minute, at the University of Indiana that you're going to be setting up, you know, how much power will that generate in relationship to a Diablo Canyon?
So it's completely different. So the idea when you're with something like Diablo Canyon is that you want to get economies of scale through sheer size. Mm-hmm. Because when that kind of reactor is built, it could take 10, 15 years to build. Mm-hmm. And you want it to be able to output as much power as you possibly can. Mm-hmm. And I think even Diablo Canyon, it probably produces something like, I don't know, I can't even remember the statistic now, but is it so like 17 or 16% of like California's
10%, 8 to 10% of the base load power? Yeah,
so that's right. I think it's an even higher percentage of the zero carbon electricity that California outputs.
Yes,
so it's pretty significant just for these two reactor systems.
Right. I'm sorry.
I was going to say that the reason why the industry shifted away from that model is that because the nuclear industry was not consistently building big light water reactors like Diablo Canyon, a lot of the expertise and learning was not being carried forward to the next project. And so you would, when you finally got around to building a new nuclear power station anywhere in the States, you would run into cost overruns and time delays as a result of, you know, almost having to start over and work these things out. And for that reason, the industry, the private industry, looked at this and said, well, actually, the more strategic way to build out nuclear energy for the future is, now that the technology is at a certain level, we make these things much smaller and we modularize them, and then you can mass manufacture the components a lot faster and ship them to site. And if you do that, you can have more of an assembly operation, and then you don't lose all of that learning that you got from projects like Diablo Canyon. And so it's a sort of an industry shift to really take account of the fact that these historic problems would arise from big construction projects like Diablo Canyon.
So your first project, as I mentioned, it sounds like you're getting close to maybe getting a project approved for the University of Indiana, and it's called Kronos MMR. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's not Indiana, it is Illinois.
Illinois, I'm sorry.
It's the same idea. It's going to be built at a university.
Right.
But it's going to be a full-scale, full-power reactor system. And the reason why that's quite interesting is that I think it should be the first net power-producing microreactor to be built in the States.
Hmm.
We should be able to do that. And actually, in the microreactor race, I think we're the only company in the U.S. at the moment that have filed for a construction permit application with the NRC. That's the federal nuclear regulator in the U.S. to build one of these things. So we can objectively say we're in the lead in the race to produce the U.S.'s first commercial microreactor system. But the reason why this is also important is that this is a step change in technology, and it's important to demonstrate to the market that these things are going to be built and they can function very properly. And even more importantly, because they are a different tech, they can be built in areas where they've never been built before. Like the University of Illinois project, that reactor is going to be built in the middle of a campus surrounded by dorm rooms. The previous technology, that would not have been permissible at all. And the reason why is that the new tech, because of the way the fuel is configured, cannot melt down. So, you know, if you've got a Three Mile Island or a Fukushima, which people might be familiar with, you know, you've got a reactor melt. Now, no one dies in those sort of circumstances, but the reactor can release radioactive activity, and that could give surrounding people dose rates. But that possibility is just not possible with the new tech. The fuel can never reach a temperature at which it can melt and have a catastrophic incident. So you can now co-locate these modern reactors anywhere you want, press right up against, you know, the customers that they're serving. And so that's, I think that's an important aspect of this project, is it's completely permissible by the federal regulator because of the safety profile of the reactor system. It just cannot deliver that dose rate. And to put it into further perspective, we were doing an evaluation for a project for a big tech company, and I think the project was 840 megawatt electric, and that meant something like 40 small reactor systems to be installed. And in one scenario, we broke every single reactor in the worst way possible, and just as a theoretical exercise. And the dose rate delivered to somebody just standing next to all of those reactor systems as they simultaneously broke in the worst way imaginable was the same dose rate as eating a banana. that's the risk, you know, just bananas, you know, is how you can think about sort of the risk profile of these new generation of reactor systems.
Do you have the same issues with disposal of the nuclear fuel after it's spent that you have with the big reactors?
So it's very different because the way the fuel is now configured, and this is how most small modular reactor companies and micro reactors are building their fuels, is that the fuel is pelletized, and it's basically put into pelletized form, and then it's coated with the TRISO fuel, which is an isotropic structure that captures all of the fission products. So effectively, the fuel has captured everything. So when the pellets that surround the fuel capture everything. So all of the fission products that you would typically have to deal with in a large reactor system are contained within that fuel matrix.
Mm-hmm.
So effectively, now you don't have a big decommissioning exercise, and the refueling is very simple. It's really fuel out and fuel in. And one thing, you know, NANO has done, our company has done, is that we went out and we acquired fuel transportation companies that have moved, you know, much more hazardous waste in the past,
mm-hmm.
Across many different industries. So we have that internal capability to come in and move that fuel. And effectively, you know, the interesting thing about the people get wrong about waste is that it's technically wrong to even call it waste. And the reason why is that when you, any reactor, even the big Diablo Canyon reactor systems, now when you have that fuel and it's spent, most of the fuel actually in those fuel rods or fuel plates or whatever it is mostly unused. Like your burn up of actual useful fuel is only like 5%.
Wow.
And it stops being functional because of the fission product buildup in the rods or whatever. So I think what the U.S. is looking to do now is that fuel that has been put into storage in the past, like interim storage facilities or long-term waste storage facilities, is that fuel could be taken out and reprocessed and power the U.S. for hundreds of years. So even waste really should be referred to as spent fuel, and we could go get out enormous quantities of uranium in the future if we learn how to reprocess it within the NRC guidelines properly.
That's fascinating.
Yeah,
well, again, that's the big knock on the big reactors, is that they have no place to. California says they won't do it. They don't have a place to get rid of the waste, and it's really a canard. I mean, in many regards.
Yeah, in a lot of ways it is. Like, for instance, it's not really waste. Like, eventually that fuel will be reprocessed, and you know, the half-life of uranium-235 is still quite long.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to sit there as long as you need it to until you're ready to reprocess it. And then, you know, already in storage, all of that waste, really, you know, really spent fuel, is, you know, there's hundreds of years of power for the U.S. just sitting there that can be utilized.
Okay, so real quickly, because we've got a few minutes, about 30 seconds left, you also have in this segment, and then I'm going to put you on hold when we hear the bumper music, and I'll bring you back on after when we get out of commercial. But you've got a reactor called Zeus, which goes on a truck, so you can truck it around to places in need, right? And then you're working on something for space. When we come back, I hear a bumper music now, so when we come back, I'd like you to just talk a little bit about Zeus and Loki, okay? Hopefully I pronounced that right. And then also what you're doing as far as vertical integration for all the levels that you need. So stand by, and we'll be back in about 2 minutes. I'm going to put you on hold, so don't go away. And folks, we'll be back and we'll be talking some more with James Walker of Nano Nuclear Energy. Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're visiting with nuclear physicist James Walker, CEO of Nano Nuclear Energy. You can call or text with questions, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. So James, real quickly, you're coming up on hopefully an approval to get Kronos working at the University of Illinois. What's that timeline look like?
So we've just submitted a construction permit application at the end of Q1. This year, and the NRC, the federal regulator, has turned around and said that they estimate that the approval time to get that construction permit will be about a year. So sometime really around mid-year next year, we should have the permission to start pouring concrete, erecting steel, and building it. And really that's going to mean that the reactor will be mostly done by about 2029, and we expect it to be fully operational, full power, and licensed by about 2030. And at that point, that will enable us to sell commercial reactors. And the interesting part there, too, is that after that 2030 timeline, the way the NRC has structured this is that the first reactor gets licensed and all the subsequent reactors after that are licensed, provided they keep to that spec. Then that will allow for fleet deployment, so many reactors to be deployed to many different locations.
So tell us pretty quickly about Zeus and Loki. What are the applications for those?
So Loki is almost like a shrunk down Kronos. It's a high temperature gas reactor. It utilizes TRISO fuel. But the thing that you touched on it a little bit at the start here when you were talking about you read Project Hail Mary recently or saw the movie. It's you know, we don't have. Oh, what was the, I can't remember the name of the bacteria in the book that powered ships.
I can't.
We don't have that yet.
I can't remember either. That's how much I enjoy. I like the book. I just can't remember that stuff after I read it.
Me too. I also read it, and I've forgotten as well. So you know, I can. But we don't have those. You know, that miracle technology yet. But we do have nuclear power. And the interesting thing is that there really is no space exploration without nuclear. And and that's for many different reasons. So chemical rockets are wonderful to get you into space. I think that you can keep making those more efficient and. Musk and NASA and, you know, Jeff Bezos will continue doing that. But imagine you do have a moon colony or something like that. Now, you can't use wind up there. You certainly can't use hydro or geothermal, but you also can't use gas or coal or oil because you would need to transport enormous amounts that is just not energy dense enough that justifies the economics. And even solar, you can't use in space in somewhere like the moon because the lunar night cycle is like 2 weeks, so it's going to be dark for 2 weeks at a time. And so you're going to be in this position where the only thing you're going to actually have available to you for consistent baseload power to keep people alive is a nuclear reactor. And so the Loki system that we're working on is that system. It's designed to be a baseload power system that can be deployed to somewhere like the moon or Mars and provide long-term power for space exploration and space colonies. And that's the direction that everyone wants to go in at the moment because you will need sort of a long-term deployment site if you're really serious about getting deeper into space. And how that could even look is that there could be launch pads out or on somewhere like the moon or Mars in the future. But even then, they would need consistent output of nuclear power to be able to deliver the power necessary to support and sustain those systems. And nuclear goes even further than that. Eventually, if you want to go deep into space, the chemical rockets won't get you very far. You're going to need much more densely packed energy in the form of something like uranium to get that long-term thermal propulsion. So you're going to have to switch over from chemical rockets once you're in orbit over to some sort of nuclear device to provide that thermal output. And then you can consistently keep producing power as you go deeper into space, which is, you know, how even the Voyager spacecraft, which I think is the furthest deployed ever man-made craft, they were using just a radioisotope, like a plutonium-based radioisotope, to get that consistent ability to provide power over decades and decades and decades. And you just can't do that with anything else.
It's fascinating. And Zeus is a reactor that you can actually truck it around and take it to places, right?
Yes. So the idea with Zeus as well, again, it's catering towards a different market, and this is why nuclear is getting quite exciting, is that we basically made it a thermal conduction system. So we removed all the coolant out of Zeus, and what that allows for is that you now have a system that is the most simple you could possibly make a reactor. So, you know, uranium gets hot, and it thermally conducts through a solid matrix like, you know, graphite or something like that, to an inert gas like helium that removes it to a turbine. It's as simple as you could possibly make a reactor system. But the advantage there is that you could then use it for all sorts of deployments. Like, for instance, warfare has changed enormously. Just to give, you know, a completely different example. Like, I think the Ukraine war has really highlighted how it's become very drone-focused. But then your challenge becomes, if you have an advancing line, how you keep maintaining a consistent level of power. Because if you need to use a truck in diesel continuously to provide this power to power drones, or you need some much more consistent output that can move very quickly, and then you don't have logistical considerations because your power is centralized and located. Something like Zeus could be a really interesting application for the military to sustain those kind of the drone operations. Now, that's a bit of a morbid one, but that gives you an idea of, you know, of how the reactor could be utilized for forward deployments. But again, mining projects, remote communities, you know, much more positive things that it could be utilized for, where power is very difficult to get hold of. And certainly northern Canada, it has enormous logistical challenges from some of these northern communities that are very far separated from, you know, mainline grid systems, from cities. And all of their power is currently brought in by remote diesel. It's very expensive, very logistically difficult. And you can't access human capital anymore because you can't build remote industry, because everything needs to be imported now if you're going to be relying on that kind of imported diesel model.
James, real quickly, we're coming up on the top of the hour break. How's the best way for people to learn more about nano nuclear energy, and what is you're traded on the NASDAQ, what's your symbol?
So we're traded on the NASDAQ. Our symbol is NNE. You can find more about us on our website, nanonuclearenergy.com. But we're on all the socials as well, Instagram, Twitter, and whatever, you know, all that kind of thing. Please go and find us out and sign up to our mailing list, because we've got a lot of interesting news and developments coming out.
Sounds great, yes. And I will have you back on maybe for a whole hour, because you got so much to share with people and so much knowledge. It would be great. Thank you so much for coming on.
No worries. Thank you very much for having me.
Take care. Folks, we'll be back in a few minutes.
Protecting what matters on The Right Choice, AM 1230, KPRL, 99.3 FM with Barry Fisher. Advice and information on protecting what matters most in today's world. Brought to you by Adler Belmont Insurance Brokers and their new associate, Heather Bordan, serving the commercial insurance needs of businesses on the Central Coast.
Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. PWM is the broadcast that helps you become better shoppers and buyers of services and products to protect various aspects of your life, health, and property. We also explore current events, our history, community, institutions, and local treasures that are notable and worth preserving. This hour's guest is Greg Haskin, Executive Director of CoLab, the Coalition of Labor, Agriculture, and Business. We're to chat about the new nonsense and lawsuits over the Oceano Dunes. Will this story ever go away? It doesn't seem like anything ever goes away in this county, does it, Greg?
No. The only thing that goes away is people's money. It goes away to the lawyers. To the lawyers' pockets.
Yeah, no kidding. And that's an interesting organization that we're going up against, right. And we'll talk about that. We're going to unpack Measure H, which is the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments sales tax increase, and this is going to be on the November ballot, and you're going to want to know about it and what it's going to do to you. And then we're going to talk about other slow county issues and news to watch as we enjoy the Mid-State Fair, and the summer. So, again, welcome back, Greg.
Well, thank you, Barry. Always glad to be here.
It's good to have you. You folks, you can call in with questions or comments, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. So in your last newsletter, Greg, you kicked off with reflections on Slo County from your perch of as executive director of CoLab after a year. You captured most of my thoughts, and I would call it, it was a bit melancholy, the message, I would say.
Well, I didn't mean it to be melancholy, but, you know, we're celebrating our 250th birthday of our nation, and it just seemed like a good time to reflect on what we were dealing with locally, and we have some big challenges, but we have a lot of blessings, too, and I tried to make sure that, you know, I think there's a good balance of sort of the nasties and the greatness.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing, I mean, you kick it off by talking about that our biggest factor that shapes our lives is the high cost of living.
Yes.
And how it impacts our jobs and services and so on and so forth. I mean, the first thing I thought about, and we've talked about this before, is this philosophy in California of creating false scarcity.
Yeah, that's a concept that I think is born out of liberalism. The more scarce something is, the easier it is and the more profitable it is to regulate and tax and restrict. And so we have shortages in a lot of things. We have shortages in energy. Your last half hour was all about nuclear energy, but we have our liberal legislature is trying to run out all of the fuel refineries, for example, creating a shortage. The more short we are on fuel, the easier it is for the scoundrels to regulate it and tax it and restrict it.
Right. And again, and that kind of also, this goes hand in hand in this county with the whole NIMBY. Not my backyard attitude.
Well, and I think NIMBYism is alive and well in San Luis Obispo County.
It's flourishing in San Luis Obispo County.
In some ways, you can't blame people. They came here because it's truly a little slice of paradise, and it's beautiful, and nobody wants great big huge housing projects. Nobody wants these tall instant tenement housing kind of, 10-story apartment buildings and that kind of stuff. But a lot of people are talking about housing. Some of our elected officials even, they talk about housing on and on and on, but they never do anything to make it any easier. And sometimes I think it's sort of a false flag kind of a thing.
Yeah, and it's at some level, I mean, yeah, it's we just went through this, and I won't mention any specific projects, but we've had a couple of housing projects, one in this count up in North County and one in South County that have languished, to get some reasonable new housing built here.
Well, and so the question is, do people that already have their own home here really want new housing, or would they rather newcomers just go somewhere else? And the problem is that we rely on so many people within the lower income stratus of our economy, service workers, whether it's, the waitress at the coffee shop you go to, whether it's somebody, that's doing minor construction work or simple maintenance kinds of things. And they don't have the ability to live often on the wages that they make. And so their employers have to pay more, and so we end up paying the price for that. It costs you $25-$30 to get a bacon and eggs breakfast anymore.
Yeah, it's crazy. And the other big factor, and I mean, we talk about it a lot here on PWM, is that the cost of government is such a huge factor in our cost of living here.
It's enormous. And, our county now has implemented this this new policy where they're getting a full cost recovery on almost every service that you ask of the county. So you go in for a dog license or a building permit or a permit to drill a well, whatever it is, they're going to charge you whatever it costs them to give you that permit. Mm-hmm. And so it begs the question, well, wait a minute, what about all those taxes I pay? What are they paying for? And I've got one answer for you that's very fresh. Today, the Board of Supervisors voted to fund the last stretch of the Bob Jones Trail. And that last stretch is going to cost between $10 and $15 million dollars. It's 1 mile long. So the total trail is 4 miles, and it's going to cost between $40 and $45 million for a 4 mile trail. And that's where your taxes are going.
Right.
And it's just outrageous. And nobody raises an eyebrow. Nobody says, wait a minute, why does it cost over $10 million a mile for a bike path? But that's what's happening.
So this total thing has been close to $50 million.
Well, I think in the end it probably will be. And no one's even asking how much it's going to cost to maintain
right.
the trail. Nobody's asking about liability costs, that kind of thing. It's just this tremendous gem in their crown mm-hmm. for these supervisors that think it's a wonderful thing that people are going to go out and be able to, you know, pedal along on a $10 million a mile trail.
What was the vote on the board?
It was 4-0. Supervisor Pichon abstained. He has a relationship with the gentleman who the board tried to get his property from. I think his name's Burnell, down in South County. And so John abstained. But
Heather voted for this?
Heather voted for it.
And what was her rationale?
Well, I don't think she gave a rationale. I think, you know, Heather has to choose her battles. This was a 3 votes. And so, if she'd voted no, it wouldn't have made any difference. I guess it would have been a philosophical stand, but I don't know. Maybe she's a cyclist in the closet or something.
Well, and I mean, we were going to talk about this more in a minute, but we won't now, but still... this project, it's been rationalized by the Board of Supervisors, I believe, because they say, well, it's all coming from grant money from the state.
Yeah. As if grant money just, appeared from heaven or something like that.
It's still OPM.
It is other people's money. It is tax money. And could it and should it be going to a higher and better use?
Mm-hmm.
Or at least should somebody be riding herd on this project and saying, wait a minute, $10 million a mile is ridiculous. We should do cost-cutting. We should make it, maybe a little more modest. But why should taxpayers put out that kind of money? You know, there's probably, I'm guessing, 5%, if that, of taxpayers that go use bicycle paths. And so the other 95% or more are funding the bill for it.
Well, and the other thing that jumped out of your report on this was the fact that a huge amount of this money that's being spent goes to consultants.
Yes.
The consultancy class.
Yeah. I don't know how much of it was, the county only has so many professional engineers on mm-hmm. staff. And when they need an engineer that has an expertise, they usually have to go out and use them as a consultant. And so I don't know how much of it is that versus how much of it is just somebody's buddy who... offers a few opinions and sends in a big bill.
Well, as you said, it was going to pass regardless.
Yeah.
But it's what another disappointment, because as you point out in your preamble to the newsletter, is that big government is not a productive entity.
No,
in this county.
And our county government, and its various aspects of it are all the biggest employers in
right.
the county, and so none of them are doing anything that's financially productive. And they're not making anything. They're not generating revenues that goes into the economy. It's all covering their salaries or covering, the fancy buildings that they have offices in. And so we need to have a county where there's some industry, where there's some, economic activity that is outside of government.
So, that's... well, when you think about the county government, the cities, all of the people in this county that are in health care, which that's at crisis levels. Yeah. We don't have enough of them, really.
Right.
All of this is other people's money.
Yes.
It's all being funded by government money.
Yeah.
And I mean, really, the primary private economic development in the county is PG&E, and they're even other people's money.
They're
quasi
pseudo government in a way.
Right.
Yeah.
The tourism and hospitality.
Right.
And there is no plan on the horizon to create new private sector economic development here.
No, our county is woefully behind on any kind of thoughtful economic development. They're starting to move in the right direction. We have a new county CEO, Matt Pontes, who has made some steps in that direction, but it could be many years before we see anything that's really adding to our economy.
And then in the meantime, while we're spending money on all of this, Dan Dow is scrapping for a lousy $850,000.
That is a sad story. Our county budget is $1.2 billion. It's a little over $1.02 on the paper, but then when you add in all the special services and everything else that county's also funding, it comes out to about $1.2 billion. And Dan Dow, for the last several years, has expressed a need to bring on a couple of staff people to the district attorney's office, one of them to prosecute all the additional crime that is now being covered under Prop 36. You know, for a long time, we gave shoplifters and drug dealers and various criminals sort of a free ride, and that was a big mistake that came out of a ballot measure several years ago. We passed Prop 36 3 years ago now, and the state has refused to fund it. But Dan Dow is still prosecuting those kinds of crimes that were covered under Prop 36, mm-hmm. only it's increased his workload considerably. So that's one thing. The other thing he's trying to bring on is someone who can go after fraud and elder abuse. And these are two things that are also growing tremendously in our community. Our community keeps growing older and older, and the elder abuse problem, and, you know, older people are more subject to fraud because they're not as savvy, particularly online, and they're more gullible, I guess. So anyhow, he wants to do something about it, and the majority of the Board of Supervisors won't give him the money.
Well, and then this is the last point on our government fiscal woes. Of course, Governor Newsom, I'll try to be kind, signed a historic balanced state budget that wasn't really, but it was structural deficit.
He signed a fraudulent document. Our legislative analyst's office is very clear that we are running a structural deficit of about $18 billion. And Newsom is kind of just sort of papering over it and pretending like it doesn't exist because he's trying to get through his term so that he can start his presidential run and not look bad. But we're in serious financial trouble by our state. And, you know, a lot of the state funds get passed down to the counties for programs.
Right.
Our county budget, that $1.2 billion budget, 39% of it comes from the state through as pass-throughs to do programs for things like homeless, mental health, and substance abuse, and that kind of stuff. And if we don't have that money, a lot of people are going to be in serious trouble.
So one of the things, and again, folks, I really encourage you to go to the CoLab website. That's colabslow.org, and read Greg's weekly newsletter. I also encourage you to join CoLab.
Thank you, Barry. We very much appreciate it. We have one fundraiser a year, and then we have membership. And membership, we're a 501c6, so if you have a business, you can join as a business, and that's a write-off for the business. But we do need people to join.
Yeah.
But even if you're not in a position to join, check our website every week. We put up the new newsletter, and we're the only organization in the county that's putting out updates on what's happening on a county level, you know, issues that you need to know about. Slight commentary from time to time, but, you know, usually just with a little sense of humor, a little sarcasm.
So one of the things is the last piece of county business that you covered in the last newsletter had to do with personnel matters, the county's Civil Service Commission. And you've detected kind of a uptick in grievances.
Well,
I guess this would be the term, right?
Yeah, this last year there were 19 grievances filed by county employees, and that was up from 12 the previous year. And, you know, there was very little detail given. They have to do an annual report on what they go through, but they didn't provide a lot of detail about what kind of grievances there were, if there was some commonality, if there was a trend. And the most frustrating part of it is that they just said that they had resolved most of these. There were three of them that were trending towards litigation, but the other 16 of them, they didn't tell how they were resolved. And I think it's in the public interest to know whether there were financial settlements or whether there was some kind of agreement made or how they resolved these grievances. But, you know, ultimately, those are, again, other people's money. Those are tax dollars that are being bandied around with employees, and we ought to know what's going on with our dollars.
So one last topic that I'd like you to unwrap a bit here, and well, this is going to be very important on the November ballot, is the slow cog tax increase, half cent tax increase. I mean, you know, and we all know that infrastructure, and it goes back to the Bob Jones trail too, isn't that? The trail leads us back to the Bob Jones trail. Infrastructure is the redheaded, in my opinion, is the redheaded stepchild in Slo County.
Well, I think you're right. I know that there are folks who have a theory that our County Board of Supervisors a few years ago, when it decided to deprioritize or you know, reduce its interest in transportation and infrastructure support, that they did so mindfully, thinking that if they backed off and didn't fund it, that at some point the public would be ready to increase taxes on itself to fund what they should be doing in their with our tax dollars. You would expect when you write a check to pay your taxes that you're going to get a level of service out of it, and basic roads and transportation would be included in that level of service.
You'd think so.
Yeah.
Well, and then you ask the million-dollar question here, is how these funds can be used. But I hear the bumper music.
Yeah.
So we're going to return to this on the other side of the break.
Right.
And we'll talk about this and then move on to the Oceana Dunes. So, folks, stand by. We'll be back in about 2 minutes. Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're visiting with Greg Haskin, Executive Director of the Coalition of Labor, Agriculture, and Business, commonly known as CoLab. You can call in with questions or comments, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. So just a couple of last things here on this slow cog tax initiative, because we're going to be talking a lot about this between now and the November election.
It deserves it.
But, you know, the funds, of course, they've got a laundry list of how the funds can be used. And within the list are bicycle and pedestrian improvements, so more Bob Jones trails, which we need like another, right, you know, hole in the head, and transit services, including local trolley services, may be funded if desired by a city. So just real quickly, how is this, assuming that this passes, which hopefully it won't, okay, how is this money apportioned, and you know, how is that all going to work?
Well, it's apportioned. There's a breakout, a regional breakout of it's anticipated, by the way, to raise about $35 million a year, and it will be distributed around the county, pretty much by supervisorial district, and then there's another apportion for cities, and then it's a 1% set aside for administration and 4% set aside for transit services for disabled people and seniors and that kind of thing. So, and then there are some guardrails about what it can and can't be used for, but you're right, it will include certain transit projects, it'll include safe pathways to schools and some trail stuff. Some of that is mentioned because there's a lot of grant money in that particular category. And this is what the sales tax is ultimately designed to do, is qualify our county to be eligible for this big picture state grant funding, because we become what they call a self-help
community. Right.
So in order to get some of our tax dollars back that we pay in our gasoline taxes and other kinds of taxes, we have to tax ourselves some more, which is a little ironic in my book. Anyhow, there are some good safeguards that are built into this thing, and one of them is that any of the cities that are beneficiaries can't cut back their existing transportation funding and replace it with the money that they're going to get from this. So, okay. So that's, I think, an important one. I do give SLOCOG credit for having gone around the county and really talked to a lot of people. They did these listening sessions and information sessions and so forth. And I think that they designed a measure that's probably as good as you could hope to get. What I would criticize them with is that it raises the level of sales tax that we can be paying in the county to become, in some cases, the highest sales tax county in the state. And, you know, we're just in an economy where these kinds of things hurt.
Yeah, and so this is good, and everybody in the county is going to pay this tax.
Yes,
And yeah, it's really going to raise it's will any of this money be available to unincorporated?
Yes.
Areas?
A good portion of it will be available to unincorporated. And that's an important thing, you know. The unincorporated is where the county board of supervisors have their greatest responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And the unincorporated roads in our county are the ones who are getting worse than ever.
Don't I know.
I live in Atascadero. We have a half-cent sales tax already for transportation and road projects in Atascadero. And they're doing a pretty good job of fixing a lot of our roads. But and I think some other cities are in the same boat. But the county roads, boy, they're rough.
Yes, they are. Yeah. Yes, they are. Okay, let's shift gears here to, again, another... I mean, I guess the good news about our never-ending stories in Slo County is it gives me plenty of cannon fodder for the show. But
it's boring after a while, though,
yeah, I'd like some new ones, I guess. Oceano Dunes. I mean, I thought we were... And the snowy plover, a cute little bird.
Yeah.
Tell us what's going on now with this.
Well, we have a new lawsuit that has been filed. It's coming from an organization called the Center for Biological Diversity. They are out of Arizona, Tucson, Arizona. They are famous for having, or infamous for filing suits all over the country. You pick an ecological issue that they think they can raise some money off of, and they will file suit. And you know, speaking of money, we should look at their total revenue. This is 2024 figures, but their total revenue for 2024 was $45,735,714. And their total assets, their cost of doing business was $34 million and gave them a net profit of a little over $11 million annually, with total net assets of $54,800,000. So, you know, they're big business when it comes to the lawsuit side of things. And a lot of people donate to them. You go to their website and they have, it's like a smorgasbord. You know, what kind of lawsuit would you like to be involved with? And you can just scroll down and pick one and donate to that cause. And anyhow, it's pretty clear that all they really want to do is tie things up. Make things complicated, and maybe in the long run, look for a settlement.
Ah, we got a caller. Whoa, I can reach it. Thanks for calling Protecting What Matters. What's your comment or question?
I was going to add on to that. POLAB, that's the wrong thing. They're a great organization. This BS tax thing that they want to put through, Barry. The thing that's the worst part about the tax is, yeah, we can get some of our money back from the state. That's all fine and dandy. But they're going to try and commingle those funds and save them up so they can do big projects like an overpass or whatever they're going to do, a roundabout on 46 or this, that, and the other. So your local communities, you know, if you're at Atascadero, you might wait 8 to 12 years to be able to expand an overpass because all the money went to Paso or all the money went to Pismo. So it's not a good idea. And, of course, our Board of Supervisors changed the priorities of the county to not fund roads. So this is their ploy to get us, the taxpayer, to fund them again.
Yep.
You're right on target with that. You know, what they did was they moved all the money that they should be spending on transportation into other things like homeless programs and other stuff. You may approve of that or you may not, but... you're also right. Some of these projects are going to take years and years to finish. And you know, we'll be paying taxes for a long time before we see benefits from some of those things. But it is broken up regionally. So, you know, Bruce Gibson can't, you know, Bigfoot himself in and take all the money for a project in Cayucas.
Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Somewhat true and somewhat not true, but, you know, you can do North County, if you will. So all the Atascadero money for 4 or 5 years goes to Paso Robles, and then Atascadero might get one thing out of Paso, and Templeton might get something. And the way they're trying to sell this is your local area will get funds back. And I don't know all the other jurisdictions, but I know Atascadero quite well. And Atascadero would see about $2 million a year out of that fund without matching or whatever, just in part of that tax revenue.
Out of the 34, 35 million.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're trying to say, well, you get money for your local stuff too. And that's how they're sell it. And, you know, we already did that. We passed a measure and renewed it again to Atascadero because we can manage our funds, unlike the county. I mean, right. You know, you get into the county managing funds, and it's a scary thing.
It's an oxymoron.
Yeah, they do.
Last thing I'll mention on that, on the scary part of the county, you know, let's face it, I don't think Santa Barbara County is running a deficit, and their budget, I think, is only $600,000 more than our budget, and we're in a deficit. It doesn't make much sense to me.
Jeff, thanks for calling in, all right?
You got it.
Have a great one. All right. You know, I just want to wrap this story up on the Oceano Dunes. And again, you know, what struck me about this Center for Biological Diversity is it struck me that this is the Southern Poverty Law Center of environmental scams.
Yeah. It just reeks of abuse, and it's just going to drag out more and more lawsuits. All the lawyers get rich off of it. We're all sitting there wondering if, you know, the dunes are going to be open next month or not. All those businesses that rely so much on the customers coming to the dunes, they're wondering if they're going to be around in a year.
Right.
You know, it's just crazy. Why don't we just get it resolved, put it behind us, and finish with the lawsuits?
Yep. The other thing that the co-litigant is the Northern Chumash Tribal Council, which is not necessarily the Chumash Indians.
I guess, you know, this whole tribal thing is very dicey when you start looking at who claims what and who's got the heritage and who, you know, they're not quite sure about. And there's some big business involved for some of those tribes that have casinos and that kind of stuff. And it's very hard to keep track of who's who, but the Northern Tribe Council is involved with this suit, and they're claiming that the beach is part of their
tribal homeland.
Yeah, and so they want to protect that beach, I guess.
So watch. How much is this going to cost the county to defend?
Well, it's not the county; it's the state.
It's the state.
Yeah, the state parks. They run the organization, and the state parks have biologists on staff, and they're working very hard to try to protect the snowy plover. And they've closed out areas of the dunes to protect them. This whole case revolves around one or two dead plovers that they found that may have, you know, come in contact with somebody riding an off-road vehicle.
So one of the things that I want to touch on here before we move on to a couple of other topics is, again, it's going back to nuclear power, nuclear energy. The Diablo Canyon situation is still hanging out there, and it's critical, mission critical at this point.
I'm very worried about it. The thing that's hanging everything up now for a 20-year extension is getting a bill out of the legislature granting the permit for a 20-year operation. And there is no bill yet. The legislature's moving along. They're going to be adjourned in October, and they're going on break most of August. And so the closer we get to the bill deadlines, the more expensive it gets to get a bill. You can't get a bill passed. You couldn't get a bill passed in the legislature to cure cancer if you didn't have something to offer up. You have to pay to play in Sacramento. And so they're going to extort PG&E like the Coastal Commission did for all those lands that they got set aside for hiking and so forth. Those all came at the expense of ratepayers. Now the legislature, Bruce Gibson, Don Addis, and John Laird are looking at figuring out ways to see how they can extort PG&E for more.
That's why I was just going to use the word. It's just an it's an extortion game.
Yeah, and so they're going to be they're now talking. There's three people I just mentioned. You know, when the Coastal Commission was granting their permit, those people had no problem with granting a permit as long as they got the land set aside. Now they've got the land set aside. Now they're suddenly saying, well, there's all these unanswered questions, and they're very worried, and they should, you know, slow down and take a better look at what's going on. Well, wait a minute. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has looked at every tiny little aspect of the operations there, and they've given a green light. The Coastal Commission has given it a green light. The Water Quality Board has given it a green light. What on earth could those three characters have in terms of questions that should delay us from getting our plant renewed for 20 years?
Yeah, it would. We talked about it during the, you know, when you first came in. I'd love to get somebody from PG&E, and you know, but again, I'm sure they're walking a fine line on what they want to say.
Yeah, it's tough. You know, in my book, the anti-nuke people, it's a religion, and you know, it was born out of the 60s and 70s, mm-hmm. Jackson Brown and his whole crew, but when you look at the demographics of the polling about who supports and who opposes nuclear energy, almost all the opposition comes from people 60, 70, 80 years old. Younger generations see that this is, you know, the answer, really, and they're entirely open to it. But our legislature is made up of a lot of old folks, and I'm saying that because I'm an old guy, too. And so they're practicing their religion. They're not looking at science. They're not mm-hmm. looking at the data. They're just, you know, they've got these built-in biases, this knee-jerk reaction, nuclear is bad, so vote no.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got to overcome that. We've got to get a bill through the legislature. And at some point, there's going to be a point of no return for you know, Diablo is continuing to go through its decommissioning right now. It has to by law. And at some point, it's going to be so far along in its decommissioning that it won't make economic sense to go the other way.
Well, and don't all the other assembly people and senators understand that this is 10% of our state's baseload power and that it's going to affect everybody in California?
Not those that are religious about anti-nuke.
Yeah.
They believe that they have faith, and their faith is that all these solar fields are going to suddenly come online and we're going to be kumbaya.
In the middle of the night.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. The other ongoing story here is, of course, Praga.
Yeah.
And, you know, I did speak to Greg briefly last week, and apparently, I mean, I guess the issues are that Praga didn't get its funding, so now, you know, there's some sort of loan somehow, some way in the picture for them, but it's not there yet.
Praga is the Paso Robles Area Groundwater Authority. Oh. I always like to explain these acronyms. Oh, go ahead.
Thanks for calling Protecting What Matters.
Hey, I just wanted to second your guest's comments on the anti-nuclear movement.
Mm-hmm.
It actually came out of the anti-war movement. Problem was, the war ended, and they had nothing to do.
Yeah.
Mothers for Peace were an anti-Vietnam War group. Then the Vietnam War ends, they've got nothing to do.
Yeah.
And their initial advertisements, you know, would show a mushroom cloud over a Diablo Canyon. They actually said it can go off like a bomb.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're right on track with that. And it's amazing. Every time the issue comes up at the Board of Supervisors, we get this whole league of these gray ladies that, you know, they're a bunch of grandmas, and they come in wringing their hands and worried about how the world's going to come to an end if we let Diablo Canyon stay online.
It's none of the, I spent a lot of time talking to James Walker, the first guest last week, and, you know, so much of the stuff that we've been fed for decades about nuclear power is just, you know, false propaganda, really, and it's a shame, really, because we should, it's a great power source. Thanks for calling.
All right.
Anyway, back to the groundwater situation. Yeah. I guess the good news is that the quiet title thing is coming to an end, hopefully.
Well, I like your term, hopefully. I mean, the quiet title lawsuits were supposed to come to an end years ago, mm-hmm. and they keep getting extended, and so they're theoretically they're going to finish up this fall, but I don't know yet exactly what that'll mean for Praga. We're waiting to see. You have a caller.
Thanks for calling Protecting What Matters.
Hey, I am informed that Denmark is going all nuclear.
Well, isn't that well, you know, they...
And here we are fighting over one plant that's the last one left, and they want to put all those frickin' windmills that are maintenance heavy and don't last and everything off in the ocean and kill all our fish and what.
Yep.
It doesn't make sense.
Well, nothing in the States does make sense. Thanks for your call.
Did you say frickin' on the...
No. Oh, did he say frickin'? I didn't push the button, fat. You know, the
you weren't a good enough sensor.
I know. I don't know which button it is on the panel. No, but, so
just real quickly, fortunately, I think the offshore wind energy industry is stalled out right now for California. Mm-hmm. But no one ever put any kind of a cost to that whole concept. And, you know, anybody who knows anything about engineering, about, you know, all the aspects involved, knew that was going to cost gazillions of dollars, and no one wanted to own up to the cost.
Well, you know, real quickly on the Paso Robles, because I'm gonna get music here in 15 seconds. Are the fallowing programs moving along?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And did we have any numbers on that yet?
Well, we're starting to get numbers. We'll have more numbers probably by the end of the month.
Okay.
But that will make a difference to the groundwater sustainability.
Good. All right. Well, hopefully, I'm sure Greg will have more for us in the coming month or so on what's happening. So, folks, stand by. We'll finish up with Greg Haskin of CoLab. Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're visiting with Greg Haskin, Executive Director of CoLab. Call in with questions or comments, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. Next week's show, I'm still looking for a guest for the first 30 minutes next week. I have some ideas on how that's going to go, and I might come up with maybe a retrospective on the past 6 months here this year. We've got plenty of things to talk about for 30 minutes if we don't get a guest. And then I have Danny Morgan, who is the entrepreneur. He's a serial entrepreneur, but he owns Paso Tile and Stone. And he's going to talk about his life as a serial entrepreneur and how he's really he's a great guy. He's really a Horatio Alger kind of guy. And he's also got some interesting projects outside the United States that he's working on that he wants to chat about. So that'll be a fast-paced and interesting segment. Real quickly, Greg, any final comments? Any comments on the final vote count here in the county?
I think that a lot of people were expecting them to be a little different, but it was a good campaign. We had some great candidates that ran and ran good campaigns. Some of them won, some of them didn't. I guess it depends on your own personal choice. But I think the saddest story out of the whole election was that there were 3,313 voters who cast their ballot, but their ballots didn't get counted. And there were a variety of reasons for that, but most of them had to do with postmarks and people that posted their ballots too late, or they posted them in a place that the ballot first had to go down to Santa Barbara and get canceled by the post office and then sent back to San Luis Obispo to the county clerk's office, and they got there too late. And so 3,313 people who took the time to vote didn't.
That was countywide?
That was countywide. And it just sort of goes to show how broken this crazy system is of, you know, any time within a month of the election, you can cast your ballot and all that stuff. What is wrong with just saying we have an election day program, you go in and cast your ballot? And, you know, if there, if you have serious reasons that you can't make it to the polling place, there's always an accommodation. But this is crazy, the system that we've got, and it opens it up to all kinds of questions about fraud. It opens up about people like the 3,313 that I just mentioned that didn't get their vote counted at all. I mean, how discouraging is that to think that you took the time to cast your ballot, you had something to express when you made your vote, and it didn't matter, it didn't get counted. Why not instead go back to the system that works well? And by the way, the big benefit to having an election day program is that at the day after the election, we know who won because they can count the ballots right then and there. There's none of this, you know, boxes of ballots showing up out of a closet somewhere and somebody, you know, happening to win by 13 votes after this new box of ballots was counted. You know, none of that kind of shenanigans. An election day should be an election day, not an election month.
Yep. Well, and it's very clear. And, you know, I've had to talk to a number of guests here since the election, on and off air. And it's clear that the system was created by Democrats for Democrats to win. And we're not seeing bugs in the system. We're seeing features.
Yeah. And, you know, this whole concept of ballot harvesting, that's pretty stinky, too.
Yeah.
You know, some stranger shows up at your door and asks you to cast your ballot and give it to them, and they'll turn it in for you. How do you know if they're going to really turn it in or not?
Yep.
How do you know if they're from an opposite party than what you are, and they're grabbing your ballot just to trash can it so that your ballot doesn't get counted? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, and yeah, maybe it's somebody you know and trust, but even then, why can't you just cast your own ballot? Why should somebody have to facilitate you vote making your choice?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Okay, real quickly, we got about 2 minutes left. Obviously, the governor's race, we'll cover that another time. I mean, it's too early to tell what's going to happen with that one. I think
let's just hope for indictments.
Well, yeah, we were going to talk about that. You know, let's talk about that story.
Well, very very briefly.
Yeah,
as it turns out, there's been some pretty dirty deeds going on in the governor's office for quite a while.
Yeah.
His former chief of staff was convicted of fraud and malevolence and is waiting sentencing. One of his close allies wore a wire, and it's looking like there may be a lot more indictments coming down the road because of the evidence that they gathered with this person on the inner circle wearing a wire. And a lot of it focuses around Jennifer Siebel, Newsom's wife, who ran a nonprofit, or does run a nonprofit, that the governor helped her raise money from.
That's looking kind of like a Clinton Foundation game.
Oh, it's just awful. It is just awful. You know, anybody who wants to cotton favor with the governor, well, they write a check to his wife's foundation, and suddenly they're in.
Yeah.
And she's made millions and millions of dollars doing this. And she produces these cheesy little videos that get shown in schools, and a lot of them are pretty controversial on their own.
Yeah, it's all about gay stuff.
But the nice thing is, and nice in my book, I don't know about others, is that it's starting to drag in Javier Becerra.
Yes.
Because it was one of his campaign accounts that facilitated all this fraud.
Well, I hear the bumper music, so we'll talk about ballot propositions the next time you come online.
I look forward to it, Barry. Thank
you. And thanks so much for coming in, Greg. Colab, C-O-L-A-B, slow.org. Read Greg's weekly newsletter and also join. It's a great organization.
Appreciate it very much.
And folks, we'll be back next week with some great guests, more topics. I left some on the outline. I could repurpose them for next week. Take care. Have a great week.